Good evening. Good morning. Thank you very much for tuning in. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'll be hosting with you this evening, sitting in for George Norrie. I'll also be back with you tomorrow night. We're going to talk about one of the creepiest cases I've ever heard. A serial killer's 66-year pact with the devil. Did it make him one of the most prolific killers in the world? We'll find out about that tomorrow. Tonight, our guest, Bill Murphy. You might recognize him as one of the science technicians from and investigators from Sci-Fi Channel's paranormal show, Fact or Fake, The Paranormal Files. And tonight we're talking about his experiences, research, and documentation of the spirit world. Experimenting with the paranormal. What is our influence on the paranormal and the supernatural? Do we create it? Are we feeding it? Are we bolstering it? We're hearing all kinds of interesting stories tonight. The Pearl Experiment is going to be the new documentary that Bill is finalizing right now. And this is a really intriguing, I guess, what do I want to say, research experiment. Bill, explain to me a little bit about what made you decide to give this a shot and kind of insert yourself into the science of the supernatural.
I think it was the curiosity that we spoke of earlier, where when I wanted to see if I could record media that could be attributed to a ghost, I knew about the Philip experiment, but I didn't want that active involvement like the Toronto team did of being the one directly involved with communicating. I wanted to, you know, do it more, document the process, and kind of follow the steps of some of the earlier researchers and investigators of the paranormal, but I wanted to modernize it a little bit. So it did have a certain occult-like atmosphere to it. We were sort of doing a reverse conjuring, if you will, because we weren't trying to communicate with someone who ever lived. We actually sat around, similar to the Iris Owen team in Toronto did, and we wrote the history of Pearl out first. And we also had a tragic end for Pearl, as did Philip. Pearl, when we wrote it, died at the Glen Tavern Hotel in Santa Paula, California. She was murdered during a robbery. And so it was a tragic end for her. We had all the details of appearance, sound. The name is because, you know, she wore a pearl necklace, which she would spin and make a clacking sound. And she also would drop coins in her hand, and they would all just sort of, you know, chink together. So I was thinking maybe if there's any sort of audio that would result of this, then now we've got some recorded evidence, and people don't know that this was a personality that only existed a week before the 75 people arrived at the Glen Tavern. So I kind of kept it secret, except for six people. I didn't even tell you. And, you know, I trust you with any of these kind of things I would do, but I was just trying to maintain the integrity experiment by not letting people in on it that were going to be actively recording anything. And so the ones that were involved with that weren't doing any of the investigating itself, came in for this session.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll find out a little bit more about the investigation. Again, Bill and his team told the ghost stories of the Glen Tavern Inn to the 75 investigators, gave them the different histories, the known histories of the ghosts, and inserted their story about Pearl without anyone else knowing that this was not one of the famous ghosts of this hotel. We'll find out a little bit about how that experiment went down. Was it successful? Stay tuned. We've got much more to cover. And please join me in my live chat room. Go to darknessradio.com. It's a free live chat room right on the front page. You can be a part of it. Communicate with me when we open up for questions at the top of next hour for open phone lines, the last 2 hours of tonight's show. Bill will stay with us next hour to answer your questions and insights about the paranormal. So we'll do that next. Stay tuned. More Coast to Coast continues right after this. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening. My name is Dave Schrader, sitting in for George Norrie. My guest this evening is Bill Murphy. He's a documentarian, a researcher, and an investigator of the paranormal. We're talking about a very specific experiment that he tried a number of years ago at the Glen Tavern Inn in California. He, along with a few other investigators, created and gave a backstory to a non-existent ghost. Intermingling that story with the other well-known ghosts of the Glen Tavern Inn, they, I guess, set the intention for the entire group to expect that these are the ghosts that already reside there. And then your job, Bill, as my understanding, was just to kind of sit back and watch and see, with the knowledge that these people had investigating this hotel, by placing your own part of the story into it and your own history, would it have any effect on the outcome of the investigation? Tell us a little bit about how that started to unfold for you.
Well, we realized, like many events, excuse me for 1 second. Clear my throat. We realized, like many events, you have a lot of different people coming in from different parts of the country and from different areas of California. So not everybody knew each other. So an important component was in just the history that we inserted with the actual history, as it's been reported, but we wanted everybody to sort of behave as a single group with a shared mindset. And that's when we built this little small device. There's a photo from that event, and I believe you have a copy of it as well, when we all posed in front of the Glen Tavern. And
right.
And I have on my knee that little small black box that has some moving parts and other components in it. And to be honest with you, it was modeled as sort of like a miniature illuminator. Remember that Mark Macy would use with the Polaroids. So it has creates an internal spiral and some other parts that have been added to it. And I thought if we pass that around and everybody, you know, from one to the other, now they're sort of joined, so to speak, because at least they have to meet each other a little closer now in this room, even with the hands off. And what I noticed was that when somebody would get this box, they'd hold it either to their cheek, like, you know, to the temple and head, or they'd hold it to their chest. Why? I don't know. People were just trying to, like, feel this box, and you could tell that it was running. There was something internally that was operating in it. But I really wasn't quite sure how it worked because I wasn't sure how Mark's worked. But it did have the effect that everybody started talking about this box. And I primed it by saying we're going to be running an experiment during this weekend. But I didn't mention what it was. And then we sort of set people loose. And then I had hoped that if we, you know, have this review of what people recorded, that we may find evidence of some of the sounds and sights associated with a fictitious ghost named Pearl that we wrote. And what ended up happening was a bigger surprise than we ever could have imagined.
And by doing this, I mean, you had people investigating and using many different tools, audio recording tools, photographic, videotaping, you had EMF detectors, just a completely wide array of different paranormal anomalous kind of research tools that necessarily weren't built to detect ghosts, but it seemed to have some kind of success in making communication with something. Although I guess we can agree that we're still not exactly sure what it is that we're communicating with, or if we are the ones that are influencing the energy of these tools. Talk to me a little bit about what the findings were when you started to check back with the, you know, what people believed and were reporting that they were experiencing.
Well, part of the challenge I had with conducting the experiment is that it wasn't my event. So I was an invited speaker to it, and I made the arrangements to go in before the event started to do the sort of reverse conjuring that I described earlier. So I was counting on the event organizers being able to coordinate a collection of people's recordings. And then we could look and see if there was any degree of success. Well, because it wasn't my event, it wasn't your event, it was another party's event, that was sort of the loose end that we didn't have really full control. When I say they, myself and the other few people that were involved with this, we didn't have control over that collection process. But at another event, one of your events, actually, I gave a talk about spirit photography in its infancy, not currently, but how it used to be. and people shooting into mirrors. And, you know, some of that was fictionalized in the movie with Kate Hudson and John Huston shot in New Orleans, where they would, if you looked in a mirror, you could see the apparitions. But that is kind of based on how people used to try to have a visual sighting of an entity, was by gazing into mirrors. And like in funeral homes, they cover the mirrors during a wake because it's felt that a personality could get trapped in the location via the mirrors. And so I just gave a talk about that. And when I did, a couple approached me at the hotel where your event was taking place while I was giving my talk, and they came in at the end. And they just heard me talk a little bit about the mirrors and missed everything else. And they approached me afterwards, showed me some photographs, and they showed me a photo of a double mirror. And I recognized the double mirror, at least I thought I did, of being the one in the lobby at the Glen Tavern. And that's where we conducted our little session, our little reverse conjuring, was right in front of that mirror in the lobby. So our reflections were there. We did this. And what they showed me, I said, excuse me, where was this particular photo taken? The Glen Tavern. When was this taken? Give me the date. I said, can I follow up with you, you know, after this event? Where do you live? Yeah, we live in Southern California, Santa Barbara. Here's my number, got their numbers. And then when I looked further, I ended up, and I think I told you this previously on another time you and I spoke, but I asked if they could meet yet another individual that could look at the photo with me and if they could bring the original equipment. And they did, and the person was an Los Angeles Police Department forensic photographer. First thing he wanted to do was look at the metadata that they had on the car to be sure that everything was intact, which it all was. But what was captured in the mirror was an image of a female form that roughly matches the description that we gave of Pearl. So we can only hope that this may be some sort of direct result of what we did, but not being completely satisfied, we set about to recreate the photo. We were unable to recreate this photo by having a person appear only in the reflection in the mirror, but not appearing anywhere in the lobby itself. Every time you try to recreate it, the person, a model that we used to stand there in the lobby to create the reflection was always in the viewfinder and would show up in the photograph. And you can't put the person behind the photographer. It doesn't work because then you see the photographer in the mirror. So we tried for hours and hours and hours, couldn't do it, finally had an event with another large group of people. We invited everybody to try to replicate the photo, and we couldn't. So the photo stands on its own as being one that nobody's been able to reproduce. It's not Photoshop. As I mentioned, the metadata's there, but a woman that appears to match Pearl appears in the mirror in the spot where we had this session.
What, I mean, as an investigator and a researcher, you've created something that seems to have taken on a life of its own. Above and beyond what you did at that experiment, you left the Glen Tavern Inn behind, and it seems that something stayed. How do you start to wrap your head around something like that?
I don't know if I've got the knowledge base necessary to fully wrap my head around it. The idea of thought forms, you know, it slightly predates that personal experience for me of doing the Pearl experiment, because when I went to Louisiana after Katrina and I did an interview with an individual there, which is in the ghosttown.tv documentary, and this Judy Smythe is her name, and she was the people that brought me in. They said, there's something odd about this case, because when she starts to talk about it, there's a vibration you can feel, and then you can start to see everything shaking in the location, like the furniture and the refrigerator starts to vibrate subtly. So I had to go see this for myself. And when I went in and listened to her story and we're doing the interview, I was realizing that there's a certain amount of guilt she has with the person who passed inside the residence, and she may be taking on some blame. And now she says that person who passed is haunting her. And when she talks about it, that's when this sort of physical effect starts to take place. And so I saw that and witnessed that myself, and I realized she has somehow created through perhaps through guilt or sorrow, a haunting, she's being haunted by the very person that died there that she feels guilty about. And that was when I got a grasp of the idea of thought forms that could tie back into the Pearl Experiment, and that's why we ended up doing, tied back into the Philip Experiment, and that's why I did the Pearl Experiment, to see if we could recreate that purposely, you know, with intention, to create something and to record evidence of it. I just didn't know it would end up being a photograph like it was.
Are there still reports of any other evidence coming from the Glen Tavern Inn that would lead you to believe that there is still some echo effect of Pearl?
I don't know if there's been any, I haven't seen any of the photos that resemble the photo that we had gotten, but there's certainly a lot that goes on there now, to the point where that location is, it ended up being on sort of the visitation list by those in the paranormal community in Southern California, where, to be honest, they hadn't had anything since 2007 when you and I and the other group was there. They decided they wouldn't have another event of this type. The hotel was trying to market itself differently. When I approached them, I was very sensitive to their decision, but I explained why. I shared my information, and I said, this really is just to reveal what happened in 2007. We're not trying to create this as a destination, but we want to have this one-time event there. And since then, people are going back, and there are lots of recordings that are happening, lots of EVPs. It seems like it's become like a hotbed, and now it's certainly on everybody's visitation list that comes through the Los Angeles area. Go into the Glen Tavern, spend the night there, break out your recorders, see what you get.
It almost sounds unbelievable, I'm sure, to the skeptic-minded that the human person, the mind, the spirit, whatever it is that we are, the energy, could beget and create something else or give life to something else. Did you have any psychics that may have weighed in to tell you that, Bill, you didn't create this character? It was psychically impressing itself on you so that you would pick up on her. Because I'm sure that that's another angle of the story, another way to investigate this, right, is that she may have always been there, and you thought you were creating her, but she was just helping you feel her or sense her.
People have suggested that to me, that very thing, that we were guided throughout the entire process by perhaps a personality that did once reside there. There's just no history of anybody like Pearl. Not exactly like Pearl. I mean, she's actually a conglomeration of the typical personalities that would have been on a frontier town. In this case, they have crops, and so there was a train station that was coming through. It's no longer part of the active train lines, but it was a very important agricultural town in its heyday, and that meant there was a lot of transients coming through. So the hotel certainly has a colorful past. And we took all those bits of the reality of the location and of the people that once visited there, and we made a stereotypical person that represented all these personalities, somebody living a bit on the edge, making money in ways that aren't the most conventional and wouldn't be necessarily smiled upon by the entire community. And that's how we wanted Pearl to be for this. Now, whether the creation of Pearl was influenced by somebody that actually liked that with all those characteristics, it's possible, but I found no documentation to support that, but it is possible.
Bill Murphy, our guest for the evening, will open up phone lines at the top of next hour. When we come back, how can we influence equipment? Is there real proof that this can happen? Thought photography. We'll talk a little bit about that and some of the other experiments that Bill has witnessed himself. Stay tuned. We've got more Coast to Coast AM coming up right after this. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back again tomorrow night filling in for Coast to Coast AM. Tomorrow night, it's me, Edward Wayne Edwards, the serial killer you never heard of. A man with a 66-year career as a serial killer. Did a deal with the devil seal his fate? Was he able to traverse the United States murdering at will because of a demonic connection? He's one of the most chilling characters I've ever read about and heard about. We're going to be talking tomorrow night with John Cameron, a 53-year-old retired police detective from Great Falls, Montana. His career in law enforcement began in 1979. He retired in 2005 as Sergeant of Detectives working cold cases. He believes that he has tied Edward Wayne Edwards to some of the most prolific murders in history, including the Black Dahlia murders, the Atlanta Child murders, Zodiac, the West Memphis Three, and JonBenet Ramsey. Could this be true? Tune in tomorrow to find out. And if you're interested in the supernatural and the paranormal and would like to further your journey, further your exploration into the realm of the strange, you can join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight, as I explore those topics and more on Darkness Radio. You can check it out at darknessradio.com. Click on our archives page where you can listen to older shows, or you can listen to us live Monday through Friday from the live iHeartRadio stream right on our page. And then keep yourself dialed in, because right after Darkness Radio, George Norrie and Coast to Coast AM continues your journey into the bizarre. Bill Murphy is our guest this evening. We'll be opening up phone lines at the top of next hour. If you have questions for Bill, you'd like to know more about his research, then please hang with us, call in, and be a part of the show at that time. And if you'd like more information about Bill and his work and research in paranormal investigating, then check out his website, ghosttown.tv. That's ghosttown.tv. You can find some of his documentaries like The Stanley Effect, The Queen Mary, and The World's Largest Ghost Town, A Post-Katrina Paranormal Investigation. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We have got more with Bill Murphy right here on Coast to Coast AM. Can we influence matter? Can we influence technology simply with our thoughts? In a Light in our chat room wants to know, Bill, how about a show about the power of the human mind to influence matter? Do you believe that the mind does have the ability to influence matter?
It certainly seems to, Dave. You mentioned something right before the break, and this ties into the question of your listener in the chat room about thoughtographs. A thoughtograph, you know, it's two words. It's thought and photographs, and you put them together, and it's becoming a hybrid term, thoughtographs. And that is affecting media in some way. In the case of, like, the live Polaroids, it's affecting the chemical emulsion development process. And there's, at this point, thousands of these Polaroids that seem to be having impressions made upon the imagery that you don't see with the naked eye, but it shows up in the photo. And it's not just the Ghostwriter case. And I was on your show with Joe, who wrote the book, included a big segment about the Ghostwriter case. But prior to that, it was going on with Polaroids with Ted Serios. And I have been to the Ghostwriter house, and we've had a number of sessions, and we got words appearing in those as well. And so that is direct mind-matter interaction, unless there's another explanation that we totally missed. But I bought the film off of eBay, encourage other people to bring their own film, a mix of cameras that people brought. So it didn't have to be our cameras, didn't have to be our film. Bring your own. And we put them in the cameras, and we took pictures, and we're getting some of the same imagery. And so that certainly appears to be a case. And by the way, I want to correct something I said earlier, because the Ghostwriter case also has Peter James associated with it, because in nearly 100% of the photos of him taken at that home, the Ghostwriter home, is he's surrounded by that strange ectoplasmic mist. And it's the date of his passing we spoke of, and I gave the wrong date. It's actually July 31st, 2008. But getting back to your core question, yes, it does appear that we are affecting whether it's digital media or even film.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that. I know that at the Glen Tavern Inn, you did a talk about thought photography and how some people are actually able to impress simply by holding the camera or the undeveloped film to their forehead and focusing on an image that in some cases, they were able to, for lack of a better word, burn an image onto the undeveloped film.
We did that. Yeah, we actually did that. It was, I wanted to see if I could recreate what Dr. Joel Eisenbud did with Ted Serios by pointing the camera at the head and using what they called a gizmo, a little tube placed in front of it. And the tube wasn't even our tube. It was actually one of the participants went and got a cardboard tube. And that's what we ended up using. There was nothing in it. People were able to examine it. We just held that in front of the lens, pointed at the forehead, take a picture. And out of all the shots that we did, one of them has a really odd image that nobody saw with the naked eye, but it shows up in the image of what looks like, and of all things, a black cat sitting on top of the head of one of the participants who was one of the skeptics there. He says, I'm not buying into this at all, but I'd like to be a part of the lineup trying to see what the end result is. And lo and behold, it's on top of his head that looks like it's a black cat. I still have that Polaroid.
And the way that this goes down, I mean, if we're actually able to influence some of this equipment, as we mentioned earlier, the experiment on the Queen Mary, trying to communicate with the ghost of Jackie, and all of these people focused on the equipment in front of them and watching equipment react, is it reacting because of the ghost? You know, kind of the old saying of, if there's nobody in the forest and a tree falls, does it make any noise? If nobody is there to witness, if we're not there physically to witness paranormal activity, will it continue to occur? Would we get the same kind of responses as if, you know, somebody was there, the physical element? Have you ever tried to do electronic voice phenomena work or recording of anomalies in a room where there is no human, but perhaps you leave a recorder, one recorder playing questions while one is recording to see if responses are there? By removing the human element, does that change in a dramatic way the effect of investigating claims of the paranormal?
You know, I've never tried that particular type of experiment. It's pretty smart. I don't know if the recording by itself is totally eliminating the human factor, because there's still a certain intention behind it. So you're going to record your voice or others' voices to be played back in the room. You know, there's a certain virtual presence that's occurring with that playback to the voice. You can be removed. As a matter of fact, there's nothing to say that you have to be anywhere near where there's an occurrence of this type. And Rupert Sheldrake did experiments called the stare effect. And it didn't matter how far people are from the viewer to the target. There's a little bit different. It's not totally off topic, but I want to kind of address what you're saying. Does the person have to be there? In the case of Dr. Sheldrake's experiments, it was because of what was happening during wartime, where seasoned soldiers would suddenly feel that they need to duck, that they are perhaps in a sniper's crosshairs, mm-hmm. and they would duck just when a shot would go off and the bullet would strike where they just were. So those people were somehow sensing that they were being stared at, and I think everybody can relate to what happens when you're in a traffic jam, when you feel the laser burn behind your ear and you turn around, it's a person, you know, three-quarter blind spot that's staring at you. They look away because you busted them staring at you. So people seem to sense when they're being looked at, or there's an awareness another person has on you. So Rupert took that to a very extended sense by doing it remotely, putting cameras in a room at a person, and the person would then press a button that would send a signal to a computer when they thought there was somebody observing them at a monitor. And it could be in the next room or miles away. People knew when they were being looked at by another person. So this sixth sense, if that's what we want to call it, doesn't seem to be related to geography at all. It can be great distances.
One thing that I found very intriguing, and I know that you've been witness to this as well, with equipment that's used on investigations, people begin to bond with their equipment, which then also starts to lead me to believe that we might be very much more the influence behind the evidence that we're collecting. And in some cases, we may not be collecting evidence of an actual ghost that is in a location, but whatever we've created with these deals, the Frank's box comes to mind. and which is a radio that does a sweeping frequency without stopping on any individual station, but creating a template of white noise and random audio and communication coming through the radio. And the voices seem to be elevated almost like a walkie-talkie, like they're coming through, but not part of the frequencies that you're hearing. It's like it's layered on top of them. But I've heard with you and your radio box, and I've heard with Patrick Burns, I've heard it with Chris Fleming, and I've had the experience myself, where the equipment sometimes seems to call out to you, to the owner of the equipment. And you've seen this time and time again. What do you make of that when you start hearing spirit voices, you know, when somebody else is using that piece of equipment, start calling out for whoever the owner might be?
That has happened. And that I don't know what to make of that, Dave, because with Frank's box, it's very controversial because the skeptics have a right to be objecting to the idea behind it, that, okay, you're using broadcast radio fragments. And so there's a certain amount of, element of chance. And, is it coming together and are you hearing what you are hoping to hear? But when it's a group that's hearing it, or when there's specific information being delivered through something like, a noise generator, let's just call it that, to a noise generator, and you're hearing specific information that people are scribing, like when somebody's making notes based on the opinions, like this, we think this is what we're hearing, and then you write it down, and then you can verify that information in a tangible way, then it does lend credibility to the fact that we are somehow entangled with our equipment. And, Dean Radin wrote a book about that, The Entangled Mind. And then Princeton University, they ended up doing a very long-running experiment based on that very idea that somehow the energy around a person becomes part of the machines that they operate, like whether it's your car that you sell and the new owner gets it and it breaks down immediately, or in the case of what Princeton study was based on, it was based on the fact that Boeing aircraft noticed that when machine operators that were operating the same machine presses for many, many years would go on vacation and somebody else would step into their spot, that the machines would break down. So then they started to commission a study of this. Princeton heard of that, and a student wrote a thesis and wanted to study this effect of randomness, if that's what it is. And that, do people affect randomness of mechanics? And that ended up revealing all sorts of information that does lend very strong credibility to the theory that a bit of the personality somehow becomes part of the machine, the ghost in the machine. And if you remove that person, or if that person is present, the operation of that device changes. And that's what happened at that same event that we talked about earlier, the one at the Glen Tavern in 2007. You even mentioned the players that were there. Patrick was there, Chris was there, you and I were both there, and I had just gotten at Frank's box just 3 months earlier. Went to Colorado, met Frank, I shot a piece about him, which is in the Stanley Effect documentary, and I brought it back to the Stanley Hotel, the Glen Tavern Hotel event just to debut it. It was still, the idea was still new, and we got very specific information. I don't know if you want me to take the time to talk about that right now, but we got very specific information from that one session. However, when I listen to the recordings, I can't hear any of the information. But as a group, we all heard it, and we did write it down. And then I checked what happened after that, and that was yet another surprise because it confirmed what we heard from the box.
And isn't it interesting, because you could hear it live, but it wasn't playing back on recording, whereas I have a lot of success where I will talk and communicate with the spirit box, and I won't hear things live. I only hear them upon the playback of the recording.
That is interesting. I mean, it's unfortunate that I was so excited about having that session, the Frank's box session, that I didn't set up recorders properly to document what the result was going to be. And here I am all about documenting, but it got the better of me. And it was kind of like a bit of a clown circus, because I even said the joke to everybody, how many ghost hunters does it take to operate a Frank's box? Because it was three of us. It was somebody controlling the sweep rate, somebody trying to hold the antenna, somebody trying to adjust the volume on the fly as it was fluctuating. So we were all working really hard, and yet other people writing it down. And our mutual friend, Diane Rule, is the one who placed a recorder sort of nearby to capture the result of it. And what happened, though, do I have the time to talk about what the result was?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So what ended up happening, and if you recall, this is what made me end the session there at the Glen Tavern. I said, because of what had happened with previous Frank's Box session, that I did not own the Frank's Box, but at other conferences where people were asking personal questions and they were getting answers, when they would get answers that wasn't raising their comfort level, some people were leaving the conferences to go follow up on information about loved ones having health issues. So I said, okay, I'm gonna avoid that. So I said, look, let's have this session. This is an experimental box. This one's handmade by wood. Let's just do this. The guy's name is Frank Sumption. We're gonna try to operate it here. We don't have any kind of experience with this, so we're gonna do the best we can do. But don't ask questions of a personal nature. So people were agreeing to that as the terms to conduct a session. But then somebody asked the question of, like, is the world going to remain a safe place? It seemed to be, like, such a broad question. I really wasn't alarmed by it. But what was scribed, you know, by that, again, being written down by people, was the following answer. There will be a nuclear attack, and I'm going to sort of paraphrase it because it came in groups of words. There'd be a nuclear attack on Israel launched from Syria with nuclear weapons supplied by North Korea. And it gave a date of January 2008. And at that point, I was thinking, this is so inflammatory. Here I'm trying not to have something that's going to cause anybody any angst, and now we're talking about nuclear annihilation. And, of course, there's no such thing as a contained nuclear war in this modern age. So I said, I don't want to have my name associated on this. I don't want people to run with this kind of story. This is kind of crazy. I think we've had our fun with the Frank's Box. Let's shut it down. Well, I couldn't resist but continually look to see what was happening in the news and what sort of conflicts were occurring and escalating in the Middle East. So the dates were coming, and it's like, okay, boom, it's September, I'm sorry, September 2007. So we had this thing July 2007 at the Glen Tavern. September 2007 was supposed to be this nuclear attack. It came and went without incident. So I was like, okay, well, that's what we got. You know, that's what we all heard. That's what we wrote down. Thankfully, no nuclear war. But in January, the following year, just a couple of months after the supposed date, there was this huge report that the Israelis launched a unilateral attack onto Syria and destroyed a bomb-building factory that was contracted to the North Koreans to build it. And the Syrians had declared that they were going to annihilate Israel. I don't want to make this a political conversation, but that's what the report was. And then I was like, wait a second, this report sort of ties in very specifically to what we got just a few months ago. So I ended up looking further, and once everything was finally declassified, it was posted, and you can find it, Operation Orchard, and you can see the before and after photos of this attack happening. So what we got from this box was a prediction of an event that would have been catastrophic to the entire world, not just the Mideast, and it was somehow averted. And I like to joke that I'm sure the Israelis don't use Frank's boxes for the military intelligence.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're taking your phone calls, and we'll continue talking with Bill Murphy about our influence on the paranormal and supernatural investigations. What is a ghost? Stay tuned on Coast to Coast AM for more answers right after this.